The critic Ossian Ward says that some works of contemporary art are meant to convey a message. But rather than laying out the message explicitly, these works of message art are, he says, a jumble of competing clues, philosophical puzzlers, and hidden agendas. They require careful reading or visual decoding for them to reveal their secrets. And often, he says, the meaning of a work of art might only sneak up on you after a prolonged bout of viewing. And strangely, it's these quieter pieces that can end up speaking louder and lingering longer in the consciousness than even the most bombastic and overbearing of art objects. So is Ward right about all of this? Does art as message really have all these virtues? Are the messages subtle at all? And if they are, does that somehow result in good or interesting art? I'm Alex Racy, and here with me to... You know, I always say answer these questions in these lead-ins, but maybe I should say try to answer them. Do we ever answer the questions?
Grapple with.
Grapple with. Here with me to grapple with these questions is John Farrell. How are you?
I'm well, sir.
Good to be here with you.
Same here.
I have a confession that I think beginning to be won over by one of the viewpoints that I think you've been putting forward over this series of podcasts. Should I tell you what it is?
Yeah, I'm dying to hear.
Well, I think that you've been working your way toward, I don't even know what to call it, a sort of historical explanation of what's going on in contemporary art, which is something like this. Before we get to the contemporary period, quite a while ago, we have these works of art, which are what we think of as fairly standard painting, sculpture, theater, architecture, literature, and so on. And they have artistic merits. And there's also another thing that goes on, which is that we put at least some of them in galleries, and then we go to the galleries, and together we have an experience of what you called shared consciousness, right? In addition to seeing the aesthetic merits of the works of art, we also have the pleasure of being with other people and talking about those merits and sharing them. And then your idea is that as we come forward in time, people are stretching and stretching the idea of what art is, until finally, what they're putting in museums is no longer art. But the reason we're still putting it in museums is that even though it's no longer art, we can still have the shared consciousness part, right? So we can show a film of somebody punching a time clock every hour for a year, and maybe that's not art, maybe that's just some weird endurance performance, but we still can get together and talk about what we make of it, and that's, in your view, why it's still in a museum. So it's not in a museum because it's really art, it's in a museum because we not only loved art to begin with, but we love the shared consciousness and we want to keep doing that.
Yes, that's very close to my theory. One way of thinking of it is the placebo effect, where we have a kind of placebo reaction to the so-called art that's been put out in the same grey old frame, in the same grey old places as in the past.
The placebo effect is that we think it's art, even though it's not.
And in the same way that when you take a drug, which is actually meant not to be effective, but to merely test your response, you may actually have an improvement in your condition.
And so the equivalent of the improvement is, first of all, we confusedly call it art, but also we actually, something does really happen, which is we get the joy of shared consciousness.
Yes, and perhaps that's one element of placebo effects, right? That we are sharing into a kind of scenario of taking a pill, feeling better, going to a museum, feeling better, has a minor effect of improvement.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I thought you'd want to know that you're winning me over a little bit. I'm not as convinced as you are that these things we've talked about are not works of art, but that's a discussion for another time. But I'm headed in the direction of your historical explanation of these contemporary works.
Well, I guess another step you could take that would be halfway to that would be, okay, maybe they are artworks, but given the restrictions in the medium that have been accepted as standard now, for instance, in painting, you don't any longer expect people to appreciate that you can draw somebody's face powerfully, right?
Right.
It's not about reproduction of the way people look, but rather you have to do something else. And maybe that'll only be making splotches on canvas. Even if we still call that art, the reduction in the medium is so drastic that what may really be explaining our response is the placebo effect more than what's actually there. That's halfway to my view. You might come that far.
So should we turn to the chapter for today?
Yes, please.
So this is one of the chapters where Ward makes something like a theoretical argument, claiming that there are certain great benefits to message art, at least message art that's not polemical or didactic, but rather kind of indirect or elusive. And the plan today was to discuss him more on that theoretical level rather than just analyzing specific artworks the way we have done in the past. But still, we can't do theory alone. You've always got to have some examples. So maybe we should introduce to the audience a couple of examples we thought we might use for today. So one is by Miroslav Balka called Play Pit. Did you want to describe this or me?
I guess I could describe it. First of all, it's located in Sweden at a facility, I believe, near Quislingen, owned by the Wanas Foundation. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that authentically. And it's a grounds, it's a some acres of land, and it has a number of different kinds of exhibits on it. And they're all more or less kind of architectural features of the landscape of one kind or another. And the idea is that it's kind of like a treasure hunt. When you're on that property, it's very beautiful. You can wander around and find various kinds of strange structures.
It's like an outdoor sculpture garden, except what they have are not sculptures. They're some sort of contemporary, who knows what, but that's what we'll get to.
They're who knows what or what the heck is this.
Yeah.
So you're encouraged to wander around and confront that thing that we are doing all the time in this podcast, which is, what the heck is this? What makes it art? What's it trying to say? You encounter it. And this particular work is a kind of pit with two marble slabs on the side, tilted up, and the pit is full of little balls, which are either blue or yellow, which are the Swedish national colors. So there are the little light balls that children might get in there and bobble around in, play with, and the obvious thing to compare it to is a grave, right? It's dug like a grave with marble around it, and so I suppose there's an attempt at a contrast between the childlike character of the contents and the somewhat ominous character of the form.
Right. I mean, I think if people want to visualize it, what they should think is, so first of all, it is an actual pit dug into the ground. It appears to me to be square, maybe 3 feet by 3 feet, and we don't really know how far down it goes into the ground. Somebody described it as the size of the end of a coffin, so I don't know if coffins are 3 by 3 on the end, but something like that. And, you know, you said it's full of these balls that children might play in, and they really do look just like the balls you'd see in a children's play pit at, you know, Chuck E. Cheese, or I think IKEA actually has play pits, you know, where your kids can go jump around in the ball pit while the parents are shopping or something like that. And then it's almost as though it has a hatch, a two-part hatch, which is opened outward in two directions. And, you know, there's some sort of slabs of rock or something like that. They don't look totally like a hatch to me. I didn't see any handles on them, but they suggest, you know, a hatch. And they're suspended at sort of 45-degree angles, as though, you know, the hatch has been opened and you've found a child's play pit in what otherwise would be a hole in the ground, something like that.
Yes. And this is one of those works of art where I do feel that we're at a disadvantage not seeing it, right? Not being out there wandering around in the lovely green. And then all of a sudden you come to this structure that's both marble and therefore lovely in one way. And then it has the colorful yellow and blue balls that are childlike, and that might give you a certain kind of sensation, which is hard to imagine here in the living room.
Well, and we'll talk about that as we talk about whether or not this art as message has any value. But maybe we should also get a second example on the table that we can use as we talk.
Okay.
So the second one is by Francis Alice. I don't know how to pronounce the name. A-L-Y-S. Alice, maybe? I think it's Belgian.
Alice sounds cooler.
Okay, let's make it Alice. And it's called The Green Line, and it has a subtitle. And the subtitle of the artwork is, sometimes doing something poetic can become political, and sometimes doing something political can become poetic. So do you want to take a crack at describing this again, or should I?
Well, this a Belgian artist, who now lives in Mexico City, went to Jerusalem, and what he did was he took cans of green paint, and he trailed around, letting them drip behind him, to make a green line. And this green line is tracing the line that was drawn in 1948 at a ceasefire between the two sides, Israel and Palestine.
Right after the Arab-Israeli War.
Yes. And for a long time, it was the border of Israel, right, until 1967, when further wars increased at 67-73, increased the borders of the territory of Israel. So that was it. He simply traversed that line, which was originally drawn on a map, I believe, by Moshe Dayan. It was a green line on a map. And so he retraced it. And he was filmed doing it. And then it was reprised, it was represented in various museum exhibits. One was a reconsideration of all of his work. And so it's been objectified in some way as something that can be presented again. But the actual work, according to him, I think, is that he made that green line.
Right. The film is just the documentation of the artwork. It was him walking around dripping paint after him that was the actual artwork. And if people want to visualize this, they shouldn't visualize just little drip drips here and there. He took a paint can, he punched a hole in the bottom of it, and he's walking around, and there's a line of green paint behind him. And although it's not our subject today, I have to say one of the first things that occurred to me is, I can't believe that anyone would do this. I mean, he's just messing up city streets, right? I mean, somebody presumably had to clean all this up.
Yes.
He traced a 14-mile green line around Jerusalem. That's what he did. Well, so should we go back then to this? I said we were going to talk about a theoretical question today.
Yes.
About art as message. I mean, what Ward says in this chapter is that art as message can have a certain special effect. He knows that art that's based on a political message can come across as hectoring or overly polemical. And he says that truly memorable works of art shouldn't do that. They should present what he calls multiple solutions. Here's a quote from him. "The inbuilt ambiguity of much contemporary art can be infuriating for the viewer who has to juggle the role of judge, jury, and executioner while the artist merely presents his or her case in any oblique register they choose." But then he goes on to say that there's something good about this. Again, continuing the quote here, he says, "It's these quieter pieces that can end up speaking louder and lingering longer in the consciousness than even the most bombastic and overbearing of art objects." So this, I thought, was worth talking about. I mean, he seems to be saying that these artists, by doing something that's in some ways ambiguous or vague, and we'll have to talk about what exactly it is that's going on here, but that somehow they're creating a kind of special effect with their art that's important or interesting. So what do we make of that?
One thing to point out is that he does have a criterion for value that comes up again and again and again in the book, which is that you remember it, memorableness. I think that's a valid criterion, that if a work of art is going to be valuable, that it has to make an impression on you that you wouldn't remember. That's not the whole thing, but it does seem to make sense to me that you should remember things. And it's also a very minimal criterion, right?
Yes, if there were nothing more to the value of art than that you remember it, that would be pretty minimal.
Yeah. Yes.
And in this case, I think he believes that the reason it's memorable relates to this ambiguity in the art. Because when an artist presents you not with some clear point of view, but instead presents you with a sort of vague gesture toward a point of view, or even gives you both sides of an issue, you then have to think it through on your own. At least that's what he believes. And then once you think through something on your own, we all know it's more memorable to you. So take Playpit. I mean, he says about Playpit that on the one hand, it's reminding you of these childish times that we all have playing in a ball pit. On the other hand, it's a grave, and he thinks you therefore have to think about the contrast between the joys of life while you're here on earth and the fact that you will spend most of time as nothing. And then he reports that he went and thought about this in great detail, and it keeps coming back to him year after year. He thinks about this issue. And of course, it's going to be memorable if you think this through on your own.
The concept of ambiguity does require some discussion, I think, because there are, it's not clear to me that that Playpit is ambiguous in the way he's claiming. What it seems to be doing is rather obviously putting together opposing materials or opposing themes, if you like. Childhood and grave. It seems like a very deliberate juxtaposition. So I don't necessarily feel that the art is making you question what it's really saying. It seems fairly clear. It seems like a pretty clear concept that the artist is working with. You take a grave and you fill it with toys. And that creates a definite feeling of incongruity. It's fairly easy to pin down.
Right. I agree with you that in that sense, the art is fairly obvious. I mean, I guess what he would say from his point of view is that the artist is not just trying to get you to see these two incongruous things next to each other. The artist is trying to get you to ask some sort of questions about how you put them together in your own viewpoint on life, right? How do you reconcile the fact that we are
Yes.
We have a life full of childish joys and the fact that we are all mortal, and there's this thing at least that we think of as a terrible ending coming. And I also agree with you that ambiguity is not quite the right word for this. I mean, really what's going on is that the artist is refusing to say that one of these two ways is the right way to view the world or the thing to focus on, and is trying to get you to think about how you reconcile them. So really, it's not ambiguity. It's just that the artist is asking a certain question and not giving you the answer. And that could make it memorable because, as I said, if you have to think through difficult questions on your own, you're more likely to remember what you thought about it.
And one thing that's interesting to me about this is that, I mean, you could separate the two experiences, really. Wow, you're walking along and there's that thing. Huh, child death. But, I mean, it's you have an experience there. That's going to make you feel something. Then you say, well, now this is by an artist and it must have some deep meaning to it, right? So how should I interpret that? Do I have to consider my own life, and am I just playing around while the grave is waiting for me, or something like that? That kind of question is something that some of the artists in the late 19th century and after said, we're not going to do that anymore. That's the average person's idea of art as conveying some deep moral or ethical message. We artists are interested in the medium of art, right? So we're going to quit that. And artists really quit doing that for the whole 20th century. And now it seems to me in this phase of conceptual art, because everything else is so minimal, that we've gone back to the artist as the person that gives you a motto, right? It gives you a deep life lesson that you have to figure out for yourself. But I'm not really sure that there's anything to that. Why should we expect the artist to have some kind of authority that forces us to pause? I mean, it kind of suggests he knows, right? The artist knows, has had some kind of insight or epiphany about life and death, childhood, age, and something, and we're supposed to figure it out. Whereas it seems very unlikely that that's the case.
Right. I guess I didn't take it that we were supposed to believe that somehow the artist who created Playpit, Balca, had some deep insight into life and its meaning or lack of meaning. I thought that what we're supposed to believe is that maybe he had hit on an interesting question, and more importantly, had hit on a particular memorable way of making us think about that question, or interesting way of making us think about that question. Because, you know, as we know, there are all these sort of common questions and bits of wisdom throughout human life. And what you want is somebody who can make them resonate.
Yes.
Give you some new angle on them. And whether that happens in Playpit or not, I think that's what we're supposed to believe is valuable about it, is that this art has somehow presented these questions in a way that makes us think about them in a new way or from a new angle, or really stuck them in our consciousness in a memorable way.
Well, if one of us were a really talented critic, what we might be able to do is to say not what the answer that Balca is suggesting is to that question, but what precisely is the angle that he takes on it. What? How is it different to have that question posed to us by this particular presentation rather than another one? What does it emphasize?
Yeah, I mean, I thought a little bit about that. I'm not sure I would say that Playpit gives you a new angle on this old issue, but I think that the value of this, if there is one, is that it's a particularly memorable thing, especially when you see it. Because as you pointed out in your opening description of it, to take a grave, which is already a terribly striking thing, and to put a play pit inside it might be a way of, you know, really emphasizing in your consciousness, this is an important question, you've got to deal with it. And maybe that's supposed to be the value of this artwork.
It seems to me a rather sweet and peaceful presentation of death. Not frightening particularly. Rather calm and comforting. Even though there might be some irony in the seeming naivete or unawareness of death that you associate with toys. So I did think it had a kind of angle, if you like, a kind of a way of shadowing the question. I thought it was, you know, a recognizable statement of a certain kind. And it wasn't to me the ambiguity of it that was powerful, but the fact that it does seem to, it poses a question that you have to figure out what it is, right? You say, wow, grave, wow, toys. It doesn't say, think about death now. And then beyond that, it has a certain tone to it, if you like.
Well, should we move on to our next artwork,
sure.
The Green Line? So again, I think what's interesting here is to take these theoretical remarks by Ward and see whether they prove to be true or false when we, you know, put them to the test with a particular case. And again, he seemed to be thinking that somehow a certain kind of ambiguity or unclarity or lack of definitiveness made these artworks better. And the Green Line certainly certainly has some unclarity. I mean, it's certainly unclear to me what this artist actually was intending to express by walking around and creating this line. And I guess the question is whether or not that is a merit of the artwork. Is it good that we look at this thing and we say, he's saying something about the Arab-Israeli conflict, but we don't really have any idea of what it is? Does that make the artwork meritorious?
I mean, no, I'm not sure that I agree that it's all that ambiguous.
Oh, well, what do you think it's
I know I'm messing this up because we're never going to get talk about ambiguity if I can't find any in the example.
Well, no, that's fine. But you think there's some clear message with this?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that it's anything but, hey, this was supposed to be roughly the size of Israel, and now it's been expanded. And it just seems to me a fairly obvious statement of protest against the greater Israel, the larger borders of Israel. I mean, I can't imagine that's really not what it's about.
I see. I was thinking there was at least one other interpretation, which is that he was just trying to get you to think about where the borders ought to be by reminding you that they are not, or that they don't have to be in the place that they are now, which would be a much more ambiguous message.
Maybe I'm just embodying the tendency of people in our day to think in black and white terms and to say, which side of this conflict would this message fit on? And it obviously fits on the Palestinian side, not on the Israeli side.
Right. Well, and that's an interesting point because so let's move beyond the green line because maybe that's not a good example for us because we didn't interpret it the same way. But what you just pointed out is that one thing that art might do if it were ambiguous, and we disagree about which artworks are ambiguous, but if it had a kind of ambiguous or mixed message, is that it could try to snap you out of this tendency that we all have and that's probably amplified at this moment in history to think in black and white terms, as you just put it. And it seemed to me that that could be a way in which Ward is correct and that some ambiguity in art could be useful. And really, there are two points here. One is that it might actually do something good for your mind. And art might encourage you to think less in black and white terms.
Yes.
It might also make the artwork more true, if I can put it this way, because the world is not as black and white as we like to think of it. And you want artworks to somehow, at least a lot of them, express the truth. And so when artworks reflect the subtlety of the world as you find it, they are closer to speaking the truth.
I agree with that. And ambiguity, of course, is one of the traditional resources of art, right? All traditional art, one of the, and rhetoric in general, right? You mislead, you lead your listeners down a garden path occasionally and then change directions. You do your very best to keep as many possibilities open as possible, and just as a person who wants people to pay attention to what he or she is saying, right? And works of art are especially able to do that because they're very large, complex utterances, especially in stories involving people and their actions. We tend to think in terms of, is the character doing the right thing? Is this a good person? And so often, great stories give us many points on both sides of the question. And that's a very deep way of involving us in art. So I agree with him about that, that art is one, ambiguity is one of the resources, one of the classic resources. However, I'm also very aware that in the 20th century, in literature and elsewhere, ambiguity became a kind of sine qua non, right? That it would be wrong for an artwork to say something straight out. That it must involve us in doubts, ambiguities, unresolved contradictions. To resolve them would be false, fake. And in a way, that's part of the discomfort with the idea of truth and meaning in modern culture, right? That we don't want to be didactic. That's going back to the pulpit. And we have, art has to do something else. So there have been theories about literature that literary language is fundamentally ambiguous. All literary language is ambiguous. And that's the reason why literature is good, because it involves you in ambiguity. And so whenever you're reading a work of literature, all you're doing is basically figuring out how the two sides cancel each other out. And that's a way of not really grappling with the things that art is saying, in my view. So Ward's emphasis upon ambiguity, to me, smacks a little bit of that. We don't want art to be didactic. We don't want the artist to say something clear. We'd rather have him merely provoke us in some way.
Right, and you're thinking the middle position is something like, you know, there might be truths in the world that we want art to communicate.
Yes.
But those truths are complex. And sometimes it's okay to speak the truth so long as you're speaking the truth in all its subtlety. And that's where the ambiguity and so on comes in. But that doesn't mean that you can never take a stand on anything.
Right, which is where literary critics often come out. And many art critics have some of those tendencies as well. Now, of course, art, when we say have a meaning, have a message, that sounds like something we say about language, right? About verbal productions. And obviously, a work of art, a physical work of art, visual art or sculpture, isn't supposed to have a verbal content, right? It's supposed to have a presentation to you that moves you in some way. And that's different, too.
Although in the case of The Green Line, you thought there was a fairly clear presentation of an idea, and maybe that was part of what was wrong, is that it was just too simple a presentation of one basic idea.
And I have other problems with it as well. You know, when you look at the way these artworks line up in these various careers of the artist, that does give you a lot of insight into what's happening. And in this case, this fellow, he's not, as far as I know, directly involved in any way with the Arab-Israeli situation or the Palestinian-Israeli situation. And he's a Belgian, and he lives in Mexico City. And so when you see the exhibit of his artworks altogether, this statement is in there with, in whatever way he has of presenting the time that he let a fox loose in the British Museum, the National Gallery in London, and when he had a large block of ice pushed around in Mexico City until it melted, and when he, as the website says, persuaded people in Mexico to move a sand dune 4 inches from where it started as a way of showing the monumental character of labor or something like that. You know, this statement about the Arab-Israeli conflict comes to seem like one in a series of pranks, and I just don't find that very impressive.
Do you think that Playpit comes closer to hitting the right mixture of saying something but also not saying something too simple that we were talking about earlier, what both you and I seem to agree is sort of the sweet spot that art tries to aim at?
No, I think it could be satisfying as part of an afternoon in Quislingen. I don't think it's going to be a deep statement about death and life that's going to change your life. Unless you're, you know, perhaps you're a person that is particularly ready for a statement about that, and it might really mean something to you.